Accession number 4627, reel number 1.
Unit, Roy Bolting, reel 1. Could you tell me briefly about your childhood?
No one can ever talk briefly about one's childhood. But if you're asking me, how did my brother John and I get into films, it takes us right back to our nursery days. We had a nanny who had, as one of her main tasks, the job of, after lunch, taking us for long, brisk walks along the promenade at Hope. I think, no matter what the weather was like, whether it was raining, the wind was tearing, it was good for our characters, good for our souls, and we hated it. And then one day, over lunch, Nanny said, boys, supposing today we don't go for a walk, would you promise not to tell Mummy? And so we knew something was, there was something that she didn't want known, which placed her in a very vulnerable position. And what it was is, would you like to go to the cinema? I mean, would we? We had never been to the cinema. And what transpired was that we had to walk in from Hove to Brighton and went to a cinema, I think it was called the Regent, which was the super cinema at that time. And a film was being shown called The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, made by Rex Ingram. And there was a man in it called Rudolph Valentino. And, of course, Nanny was very much in love with Valentino. When we came out of the cinema, it was... I can only compare it to Paul's experience on the road to Damascus, that both John and I were changed men. And we knew from that moment, I think we must have been, 7 or 8, but we knew from that moment that that's what we were going to do, make films. What else?
When did you begin to make films?
I made my first contribution to a film when I left school. I went to Canada. It was really partly to get away from the family, from what I felt to be a rather cloistered atmosphere. And I desperately wanted to get away. Something told me I had to get away. And when I was in Toronto, I was working as what they call a sales clerk in a department store. I met a man called Rothwell Jackson, and he was from Hollywood. Oh, that conjured up wonderful images for me. And I'd done a spot of writing, one or two pieces in the local papers. And he said, I'm making a film down at Trenton, Ontario, called Even the River. And how would you like to come down and write some of the dialogue and the commentary? Well, I think I was 18, 19. So you could imagine just how immediately I jumped at the opportunity. And so I went down, spent 3 or 4 weeks there. I was paid nothing. But it only just confirmed my utter commitment to film. So that was my first so-called unpaid professional experience in films.
And your first professional experience?
Came back, and John my brother John, my twin brother John, by that time had got himself a job with a small distributor in Water Street. And he was a general factotum in the office. And eventually he was invited to take somebody's place. They had been the West Country salesmen for these, I'm afraid, mostly very indifferent films that the company was turning out. And so he was already established. And one of the men making films for this company was a producer with the extraordinary name of Widgie Newman. And John introduced me to him, and he gave me a job as a general factotum on the studio floor. And that meant sort of taking tea, making tea, looking after the artists, and shifting the lamps around. In those days, you could do those kind of things, painting the scenery. I never forget one. On one particular day, we were just finishing a film at Bushy Studios, and there had been the most appalling mining disaster, in which there were 200 or 300 men involved, and tragically. And Newman, who was a man who could, I think, have been a great man had he not been fatally flawed as a human being, innate vulgarity. He spoke about five languages. He was a sort of pioneer aviator. He was a pioneer racetrack driver. He used to write prescriptions for me if I had toothache. And the chemist would accept it and dispense. He said we were finishing a film on the Friday. And he said, he had a very husky voice. He said, Roy, he said, I'm going to make a film starting on Monday. This was Friday. He said, I want you to go out and buy 3 tons of coal. I said, 3 tons of coal? What for? He said, we're going to make a film about a mine disaster. And indeed, on the Monday morning, we had a man called Moore Marriott. We had a man called Terence DiMani. We had a man called Wally Patch. They were all actors of the past, and in their own way, extraordinarily skilled. I mean, if you can imagine these various characters playing North Country coal miners, it was incongruous. But those were the kind of things that happened in those days, you know.
And when did you get round to producing Pastor Hall? How much longer?
I did about, I suppose, what, between 32 and the middle of 37. I worked in so many different capacities. There was a man called John Miller, cameraman, and also editor for this man, Newman, who really taught me the basics. I should never be able to, sort of satisfy the debt I feel that I owe to him, because he really was marvelous. Mind you, I must say this, that it took a long time. In the editing rooms, for example, where we were still using mixtures of acetone and acetate to join films, he, I think, was very doubtful about me. And he offered nothing, suggested nothing. I just took the film as he cut it, took the trims, put them away in tins, and said nothing. I said nothing to him because I knew But he was a man in his middle years. I was a youngster by comparison. And I knew that I had to earn his confidence. And then one day, after about 6 months, he suddenly turned from the movie era and said, "Roy, come here. Tell me what you think about this." And then I knew that I had established myself in his eyes. You know. And we became enormous friends, great friends, as a result. And I worked as assistant cameraman for him, as well as assistant editor. And there we were. Now you want me to move on to Past the Hall?
Yes.
Well, in 1937, John, who had had some depressing experiences as a film salesman, but learned something about selling and distribution, he and I got together, and we decided it was time to make our own films. And with the aid of, with the assistance of friends who had some kind of confidence and belief, perhaps misplaced in our talent, we raised enough money to start making a film. And from there, our first film was a disaster called The Landlady. Our second film was, by comparison, an enormous success. It was based upon a radio play of Lawrence Houseman's called Consider Your Verdict. Our played at the Academy for about 16 weeks. Our third film was a film called Trunk Crime, which played at the Curzon Cinema. So you can judge from where these films were shown that already the Boltings were achieving a most unenviable reputation as being rather arty crafty. Then after Trunk Crime, we made a film called Inquest. Now all these films, quite unconsciously, but because we were interested, had a kind of social, it's an awful phrase, but I can't think of anything better, a kind of social application, a social significance. It dealt with some aspect of British life. And we had tried in at the beginning of 1938 to raise the money and make a film called Past the Hall, which was based upon a work by the German poet Ernst Toller, who had taken as his central character a Lutheran pastor, similar to the First World War U-boat commander Pastor Niemöller, who was thrown into a concentration camp eventually. But he had taken a character, and really it was set in Nazi Germany. And it was a film that we felt very strongly about. However, at that time, there was a man called Brooke Wilkinson. Brooke Wilkinson, I think, yes, that's what it is. He was the censor, and he clearly felt very strongly himself that this was a film that should not be made. And it should not be made because, unhappily, for our country, I mean, the stench of appeasement was very much in the air at that time. And he clearly endorsing Mr. Chamberlain's vain idea that the fascists, Mussolini and Adolf Hitler, could be bought off, said, "Under no circumstances will I give this film a certificate if you make it." So we had to drop the idea.
Was this the first time you'd had trouble from the censor?
The first time, yes.
Mm. Were you a member of any political party at this time?
No, I wasn't. I've always found, even as a very young man, I've always found the idea of political parties as being far too constricting and far too limiting. You can say for certain that both John and I would be regarded as at that time as being very much on the left. Although I think John might have been a member of the Labour Party. I think he might. I know that I wasn't. I don't think that people working in a creative medium can accept the limitations on what they say and how they say it, that loyalty to a political party necessarily involves.
Did you make a public protest about the refusal of the censor to grant a certificate if you had made the film?
There was no one to whom we could... I mean, we weren't ourselves of note. I mean, we hadn't... We were gradually becoming known within the industry, but the press itself would have had no great interest, you know. And so we knew... I mean, we raised our own protest with the censor, and we may have written one or two letters to the trade press. I can't even remember that. But we knew that it was impossible. And we mustn't forget also that basically, I mean, overwhelmingly, the attitude, the position of the censor would have been endorsed by most people in this country. Until after Munich, Hitler went in, took over the rest of Czechoslovakia, and then people understood that he had to be fought, and we were going to have to fight him. At that time, of course, we were able to make Pastor Hall. The script was ready, the finance was available, and we made Pastor Hall.
You applied again to the censor, did you?
No. I mean, how could he resist? He was in an impossible situation. He could not have said no.
And this was one of the first successful anti-Nazi films made in the country.
I really think, although I'm sure, I'm told that the National Film Theatre is going to be running it very shortly again. But I think, seeming immodest, I think that John and I made a film that for the first time dealt with the Nazis and revealed them in all their infamy, but also dealt with the Germans as human beings. They weren't all Nazis. There were too many who were, but they were human beings. And we had a splendid cast. Wilfred Lawson gave one of the most moving, splendid performances of his long and very brilliant career. Sir Seymour Hicks played his first really dramatic role, and played it magnificently. Marius Goring, who played a Nazi, and Nova Pilbeam, who was one of the stars of the 20s and 30s, played the young girl.
And I believe an Austrian novelist called Anna Reiner collaborated.
Yes, she was an enormous help, of course, because she had a sort of first-hand experience of what was happening, you know, in Europe. And she, her philosopher husband, who was teaching philosophy somewhere, I forget now, one of the universities. But she was a novelist to some distinction. She had written a couple of books that have been published, translated and published over here. And I think a lot of the good words, the good writing in Pastor Hall really belonged to her almost as much as to Ernst Toller.
Her name crops up again in your next film, The Dawn Guard, where she is credited with the original idea.
Yes.
By.
Yes, I don't... it's very hard for me to remember. Now, I don't really think that Anna played a very, very, or a larger part in this small 5-minute film we made for the Ministry of Information whilst we were waiting to be absorbed into the services. I don't think she played that part. I'm sure she made some kind of contribution in terms of ideas, I don't know.
Can you say something about the origin of that film, Dawn Guard?
Well, as I say, at a certain moment, John and I both felt that we had no right to stand outside the services. We had an exemption if we wanted it, but we felt we had to get into the services. But it became abundantly clear, and we were told when we went up to be interviewed and so on, that it would be some time before, it would be quite a few months before they got round to absorbing our particular age group. So rather than sit around on our butts, we offered ourselves to the Ministry of Information to make one of their 5-minute films. They were making these films, and one was going into the cinemas in every program each week. And the film we chose to make was Dawn Guard, and I suppose to some extent it was again an initiative, because the MFI gave us carte blanche. We could do whatever we liked upon the basis of our having made Pastor Hall. And John and I, together with Bernard Miles and Anna Reiner, we decided that if the war, at that time the Boer War, the Phoney War, was to have any meaning at all, it was going to be fought not to return to the England of the 30s, not to return to the England of the mass unemployment, of appeasement, of class division, and so on. It was going to be fought and hopefully won on the basis that the inequalities, the disparities, and the poverty and the suffering was going to be ameliorated, if not eliminated entirely, at least the lot of the ordinary man and woman was going to be improved. Very ingenuous, very idealistic, deeply felt, and that is the film we made. I remember when we showed the first married print, and John Betjeman, who was with the MFI Films Division, and a man called Roger Burford, who was a writer, and I'm not sure, it could have been Sidney Bernstein, our Lord Bernstein of Granadaland, and they saw the film, and they... There was a silence when the lights went up at the end. And I'm not at all certain that that Sidney Bernstein wished to reveal his feelings. Burford said nothing at all, which is a very depressing thing when you show even a 5-minute film. Very depressing. But I remember that John Betjeman looked, smiled, sucked at his cigarette, and said, well, he said, I'm not sure, but I think it's good. I like it. And but that he was the only one who ventured an opinion. I think that the fear was that perhaps it went further. It was a government-endorsed film, and it perhaps went further than the government at that time wished to go in terms of assurances or beliefs about the post-war period.
Was this preview the first occasion on which the MFI had actually heard about the theme of the film?
Yes, it was.
I'm sorry to return to Anna Reiner again, but she is credited with the original idea.
Yes.
Can you think why you did give her this credit for this particular film?
Well, no, I can't remember this distance in time. I really can't. Except that we liked her enormously, and I'm sure she made a contribution. And we were perhaps seeking to provide her with a credit that might help her. But I think it was very much a sort of a round table job. Because I remember Bernard Miles, now Lord Miles. I know that he made some very valuable suggestions.
And Percy Walsh, did he contribute?
No, Percy was essentially an actor, you know. I don't think, would make any claim to being a writer.
Did you have any fears that the film would not be shown?
No, it never occurred to us, because what we felt, the ideas that were advanced in largely a two-handed conversation as a film, the ideas being advanced were, to us, nothing more than radical, liberal, sound principles. We couldn't conceive of the idea that anybody would wish to return to the kind of world we were now having to fight our way out of.
Did the MOI ever invite you to make films again for them?
Our relations with the MFI remain very, very cordial. But very shortly after that, of course, I was into the Royal Armoured Corps, and John was into the Royal Air Force. So, now that you mention it, they did, at one time, we had a friend of ours had written a play called Thunder Rock. And in 1942, the Ministry of Information believed this to be a very potent subject. And they asked us to come out of the services for 6 months and make it, which we did.
Back to 1940, at that time, what was your impression of the MOI Films Division?
It was very much an amateur show, very disorganized, hodgepodge of dilettantes, academics, odds and sods, you know, writers,